The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good morning. And I have kind of a question for you, seeing how many people are in the outer hall. It's kind of a common thing on Sunday to have people out there, and I can hardly see some of you. And I have a feeling that some people prefer to sit out there. Some people think its sound is better out there, and some people, they can escape easily. Maybe. When we did a big remodel here in this room, in the outer room, I don't know how many years ago now, 5, 6 years ago, we put in wires in the walls with the idea that we could have a video out there on the wall so the people in the outer hall could have a video of the speaker here and just be a little bit easier to see and feel part of it. And, you know, I think most of us are not very motivated by the idea of having that kind of technology as part of the Dharma thing. But I've been wondering lately whether it might actually be a good idea and actually help the people in the outer hall to feel more like they can see and feel more connected to actually have that. And so maybe afterwards, if some of you would like to say something, like, yes, please do, it would make a big difference. Maybe that would encourage us to take the next step and put something onto those wires in the wall. They would make it possible. I was especially kind of motivated to think this way again because it might be interesting for you to know, those of you who come regularly, that a few times a year we do an introductory course in mindfulness meditation here. And I do it twice a year, and other people do it as well. But we started another one on last Wednesday, and there were 150 people who came for it. And that's quite an impressive number of people for it. And we used every chair in the house. People are sitting on the floor out there. And I thought, maybe we should have a video screen out there if we can have that many people coming. So if any of you would like to share your opinions about such a thing, it would probably help. The other lesson is I think we should offer the intro to meditation class more often. Last week I gave the talk on the topic of the Four Noble Truths. And today I'd like to continue in that theme, but to offer you the flip side of the Four Noble Truths, another way of talking about them. If the traditional manner of talking about them is maybe the front of the hand, then this way is the back of the hand. They go together. You can't have them separately. The Four Noble Truths are often seen as the core teachings of Buddhism. The whole point of Buddhism is summarized in the Four Noble Truths, where the first truth is suffering, and the third truth is the cessation of that suffering, overcoming that suffering. The second truth is the cause of the suffering, and the fourth truth is the cause or the conditions that allow and bring forth the ending of the suffering. So there's suffering and its end, and there's a cause of each, kind of. So it's often said to be somewhat of a medical model for understanding suffering. They say that in ancient India, there was this common four-part formulation for doctors. They would someone would describe the illness, the cause of the illness, the prognosis, and the possibility, the medicine or the course of action to overcome the illness. And in that vein, the Buddha was sometimes called the great doctor. So the great doctor, of suffering, doctor of the heart, perhaps, if we could say in modern terms. So the emphasis in the Four Noble Truths has to do with suffering. But I'd like to the flip side of that. because we're not just supposed to be left with suffering or simply the end of it. The end of it is an interesting thing. What is the end of suffering? What is the cessation of it? And there's been a reluctance in the tradition to give a lot of specificity around what the end of suffering is, partly because then people will get attached to that idea of what it's supposed to look like. Maybe the end of suffering is not supposed to look like anything. It's simply the absence of something. And you're freer if you just appreciate the absence of it, because then you don't have to wear someone else's shoes. You don't have to wear someone else's idea or of what it's supposed to look like to be free of suffering. You can find your own, find yourself in that. But even so, at the risk of burdening you with an ideal, I would like to offer ease as the flip side of suffering. Some people would say happiness, but happiness is maybe a little bit too concrete of an ideal. People get too caught up what it means to be happy. But ease is a word that I like a lot, and perhaps it's vague enough that a variety of ways of being can be found in the word ease. But to have ease, to experience ease. And so in the flip side of the Four Noble Truths, the first noble truth would be there is ease, the possibility of ease. And the second noble truth would be it's possible to lose the ease. There's a loss of the ease. And then the third noble truth would be the way or the possibility of regaining the ease. And the fourth would be the way for regaining the ease. So ease, loss of ease, regaining the ease, and the way to regaining the ease. So there's a couple of reasons why this is significant. And one is that different people, for different reasons, maybe personality reasons, will focus more on suffering as the motivating force for their practice. And some people focus more on peace or ease or the freedom from suffering. Some people are more attuned to darkness, the dark side of life, the difficult side of life, their struggles. Some people are more attuned to the light side of life, to the brightness and to the possibility of happiness, freedom, compassion, things. And why the two come together, right? Because some people are working to focus on their suffering and are looking and finding ways to become free of it, to overcome their suffering or react to the suffering, and sometimes negatively in wrong ways. But that's what they kind of orient their lives to, to kind of get away from it or solve it or overcome it. And some people, the idea of getting away or fixing suffering is not such a big motivating force. They know they're suffering, but they have a clearer vision or clearer sense that there is a positive possibility. They're optimistic. And so they're more interested in the direction they can go, the peace that is attainable. And that has more value. It's more motivating for them, the idea of attaining peace, than the idea of getting away from suffering. So different people are different ways. I don't think any of them are right and wrong. And as I said recently, just as some people are right and left-handed, so maybe some people are suffering and peaceful-handed. Suffering-handed people and the peaceful-handed people. And, you get born the way you are. There's advantages to being the suffering-handed person, because it tends to create a more realistic kind of spiritual path. Because then it's really grounded in something that's actually we feel and experience, and it's easy to investigate then what's really going on there in a deeper way. When the focus is on happiness or peace, it's all too easy for it to be abstract, idealistic. And so there isn't an investigation of anything real. It's rather somehow living kind of a dream state or a wishful thinking that can be there at times. And I've known people who, in some kind of dysfunctional way, have focused on the ideal of peace and happiness and love and love and peace. And in doing it too idealistically, some people do it in a kind of, I've seen people do it in a kind of pastorally romantic way, where they're actually denying and whitewashing or denying the difficulties of life, their own suffering, the suffering of others. They kind of whitewash it, kind of paint over it and say, it was not really that way, life, and they just want to prance around in flowers and in their hair. And often that's a tremendous cost, because that kind of idealism that covers over one's own suffering and kind of pretends it's not there or ignores it, the suffering, the demons inside fester and still work there in the background and can cause havoc. And some of the people I think of most specifically who I've seen do this have had a huge unconscious way of behaving, where they unconsciously act angrily, for example, because this backlog, this pressure of the unattended aspects of their lives, because of how they keep focusing on the bright side, the happy side, and all that. On the other hand, there are people who dysfunctionally focus on their suffering. There are people who identify very strongly with their suffering. Their sense of self, their understanding of who they are and how they orient themselves to the world, is intimately connected to being a suffering person, being a victim, being someone with problems. And they wouldn't know who they were if they didn't have their problems. They wouldn't know how they're going to relate to other people unless they could share their problems with people, or unless they could kind of somehow see people through the frame of their struggles with them or their fear of them or something. And some people find it actually quite frightening to let go of their identification, their attachment to suffering. And some people find it such a foreign idea that there's attachment to suffering. Even people who are attached to suffering can't believe they're attached to it, because who in the right mind would be attached to suffering? But in fact, if mind gets quiet enough and still enough, and look carefully, some people will see that in fact they're quite attached to it. They don't want to give it up. They use it, and so. So sometimes that focus can be dysfunctional. So there's both a kind of useful ways of focusing on both, the suffering and the ease, and there's dysfunctional ways of focusing on it. That's one aspect. The other aspect of this focus on ease, suffering and ease, has to do with a transition or a turning point that people make in their Buddhist practice or in their practice. And that is, at some point, as people practice, the personal experience of peace, of ease, of well-being becomes immediate and direct. The personal experience becomes visceral, becomes something that one actually knows for oneself in a very clear way. Sometimes this can come almost like so strongly that it knocks the socks off people. Especially in the sometimes in meditation or in retreats, is to have an experience of well-being, of peace, of vitality, of love, of compassion, that is qualitatively stronger, more thorough, more thoroughgoing, more expansive than anything perhaps a person has experienced before in their lives, or to experience the first time in their life with understanding and insight of how it comes about. Sometimes people can drop into it by accident or by circumstance, but they don't know how they got there. They don't know what happened to make it possible. And so, you know, like for example, for me, when I was 18, I traveled around Europe by myself. And I ended up at a Catholic monastery named Mont Saint-Michel. And I stayed there in a little kind of religious Catholic hostel on the island. And overnight. And then the next day I went up and to visit to get a tour of the cathedral. Someone gave us a tour, walked us around. And it turns out this cathedral is built on a hill on a little island. And it's a huge kind of Disneyland kind of like building. It's quite something to see. But it started off as a chapel, a little one-room stone small chapel on the top of the hill, maybe 1,200 years ago, maybe, or more. And the cathedral and the monastery was built up and around that chapel. So that chapel is still there, and this old building. And so in the tour, they were taking us around, and then went through this big, you know, cathedral kind of gathering place and various places, and eventually brought us to that ancient chapel. And when we entered that ancient chapel, a peace that I'd never experienced in my life, and the kind of intensity of it kind of felt like it just descended on me, or I entered into it, or it was quite powerful for me. And so I tried to linger as long as I could get away with, just to feel and sense that peace. Why that happened? I don't know. Later I heard about power spots. You know, I don't know what happened. I could have perhaps then decided to go back every year for a second hit. Hopefully, you know. I always wondered if I went back, what would happen. Or I could have decided to become a Catholic monk, since it was in a monastery, right? This is proof that that's the way for me. But I didn't do that. So it happened, you know. But it made a big impression on me that it became. It wasn't actually like didn't like set the direction for my life, that experience, but it certainly was one of the things that showed me a possibility of a different way of living, different way of being in life than I had experienced so far. When similar things are experienced on retreats, it tends to come along. Tends not to come with such a big, sudden, unexpected bang, but tends to, either in experiencing it or coming to it, understanding what shifted, what you let go of in order to experience it, or as we come out of that experience, or as we use a perspective of that experience, it tends to be easier to understand and see what we're doing, especially what we're doing that contributes to our suffering, our stress, our tension. There's a vantage point, there's kind of insight, capacity to see. But as practice develops, you know, it isn't that Buddhists are supposed to just learn how to suffer better. You know, one-pointed suffering. And, you know, really, you know, mindfulness, it helps, you know, when you suffer, you really get to be mindful of your suffering. That's the whole point of it, you know, mindful sufferers. That's not the point. The point is to be present for suffering or be present for the path and practice in order to become free of suffering, to experience the well-being and peace, the sense of ease that's possible when suffering falls away, when the attachments that cause suffering that fall away. And so at some point, the experience of ease becomes strong enough for a person that it becomes a primary reference point for them. So instead of suffering being the reference point, or instead of an ideal being a reference point, it's a felt sense of ease, of well-being or peace that either feels present all the time or feels like it's just around the corner, or feels just right, you know, sitting on your left shoulder waiting for you if you just give it half a chance. So there's a sense of ease then that becomes important. And that sense of the importance of that ease grows as people's practice becomes stronger. And it grows in this way, that it becomes increasingly clear that it's not worth giving it up, that nothing is worth giving it up. It's increasingly clear that a useful question in a person's life would be the question, why should I sacrifice my ease with this stressful concern? Getting involved in something that's stressful, or, you know, why would I? Now, I think that some people find it inconceivable, this question, inconceivable that there's questioning of their stress and the pressures of their lives as if, because it seems so important and so integral to their life that there's demands and pressures and requirements that we have to get involved and do and protect ourselves and secure ourselves and take care of our responsibilities. And to even the idea that we're questioning whether we need to get stressed and caught up in that and sacrifice our ease is you know, a troubling idea. But you don't have to have the idea. But what I'm saying is that if you do this practice and develop in this practice, a time will come, a turning point will come, a tipping point will come when the experience of peace is strong enough that it becomes a reference point, it becomes a teacher for you. And you begin using that as a teacher to question the other aspects of your life, to question what is important for you, question what you do with your mind, what you do with your behavior and activity. And is it worth sacrificing that peace or well-being for, you know, anything at all? And what seems to be the case is that the stronger and more stronger a person's connection to this peace is, And so it's something that is continuous and here all the time. The less motivation there is to get involved in attachments, to get involved in clinging or resistance or the kind of behavior that causes us to lose our peace, causes us to suffer. And so one of the goals of Buddhist practice is to come to such a point where there is this kind of ease. And again, I want to emphasize that here it's an experience a person has as opposed to an ideal. Yesterday I read a little account of the actor Jeff Bridges. Apparently he was in a movie where he was his character was a bowling champion. Is that right? What?
Big Lebowski.
Big Lebowski? Okay, I don't know. I'm not so in touch with popular culture. Some years ago, I was leading Peter's here, right? I was leading this teen retreat, and here and yes, I remember when I told the kids I hadn't watched TV in 30 years, and these ninth graders, right? This room full of 50, 40 ninth graders, and I hadn't watched TV, and I didn't know it was on TV for 30 years, and I could see my credibility drop. And I felt I had to kind of rush to kind of regain my credibility before I lost them. I've never said that to the group again. So now I told you I don't know this movie, right? I hope I haven't lost my credibility to you. Anyway, so this I hardly know who Jeff Bridges is. I know enough that he's an actor. So he was saying how, in order to prepare him for this role, they brought in a bowling champion, and apparently his assistant, and the and so Jeff Bridges asked something like, "Well, you know, am I supposed to kind of like get into this particular mind state of being a champion bowler? A particular mind state of one with a bowling ball or one with the pins or something?" And apparently the assistant started uncontrollably laughing. Like, this is the most ridiculous thing you've ever heard. And then they told a story of how this champion bowler had gotten some kind of like idea, like from reading some book like The Zen of Archery, where you're supposed to have this ideal of being one with a target, one with a bow and arrow, and get the mind really still and just let go of all, you know, just this everything. And have this particular mind state that really, you know. And so the bowler apparently had tried to do this. And he would get himself into this particular mind state. It would take him a while to do it. So when he was playing these games, champion's game, everyone had to wait for him. You know, and the longer he did it, the more he had to wait and get into this mind state. And it drove other people crazy, right? But it also didn't make him a better bowler. It made him worse. Until finally, I guess, if I remember the story right, someone said to him, just throw the effing bowling ball. So that's what he does now. He just throws it. Not this all this thing about ease, you know. So there's danger, again, this idea of being too idealistic and kind of think you have to be a certain way. And trying to put yourself, be a good Buddhist and be calm all the time. Heaven forbid. And too, you know, if you try to be calm too much, it's a burden for everyone else. But you don't want to like make light of it too much, because there is a very palpable, immediate, direct experience of calm or ease or peace that becomes our teacher. And to let that become our teacher is part of, I think, one of the great possibilities in this practice here. And how does it become our teacher? I think it becomes our teacher when we argue against it. When we listen to all the arguments, all the ideas, all the feelings inside of us that tells us that you know, it's not okay to be at ease. It's really essential to be stressed out. It's important to be caught up with what we're doing. It's important to be, you know, feel the pressure. To feel that, you know, to really, you know, get into the pressure, you know, we have to worry. It's really important to worry. And so then you can start looking at why we're justifying it. What are the beliefs? What are the feelings? Why? Why does this exist? And if you want to take ease as a teacher, look at how you argue with ease. Look at how you complain about it. Look at how you justify the opposite. And ease is a very frustrating teacher because ease doesn't argue back. Ease provides no pressure for its argument. There's no pressure, there's no demand, there's no stress. And so it's easy to overlook the value of ease because mostly we'll pay attention to where the pressure is. And so the pressure, you know, certain the force of pressure insists, you know, listen to me, you know, you have to pay attention here. And it's often louder. Ease is usually not very loud. So it just sits there and waits for you quietly. And eventually you get around to noticing it. But you have to get quiet enough or value it enough to notice the ease. I think that there's a lot of spiritual teachers who will offer the teaching that peace is ever present. It's here now. But what is it that keeps you from experiencing it? What are the ways in which your mind is caught up in reacting and thinking and worrying? What are the feelings, what are the forces of agitation that you're involved in that limit your ability to sense and feel the peace that's here? I would say that, you know, if you make up, your body makes up, one thousandth of the space of this building, then 999%, how do you say it? 99.9% of the building is peaceful. Now, I don't know, there's 100 people here, so maybe I shouldn't say that many, but 90% of the building is peaceful. If you just kind of look beyond yourself into the space around us and the walls and this, you know, the awareness, what you can be aware of is beyond the boundaries of your body. Peace is here. So to make peace or ease your teacher, what happens to you? Try arguing with ease. Look at the arguments you have. Look at why you justify worrying. One justification for worrying that some people have, I've been told that the people learn this in their families growing up, that worrying is a proof that people love each other. And if you don't worry, you can't really show each other that you care. And is that the case? I would hope it's not the case. I hope there's other ways of showing care and compassion and support than worrying about people. Worrying and is also a way of asserting our self-identity. We don't know what to do, and so one way of kind of asserting our identity is to worry. It's also interesting to notice how much of the what causes the loss of our ease is identity issues. Me, myself, and mine. Ideas we have about who we have to be in relationship to other people. The impression we have to make. The ideas of self we have to support. We lose our ease because of the way we judge ourselves and criticize ourselves. Is it necessary to have any opinion? Is it necessary for you to have any opinion about yourself? Is it necessary for you to have an identity for who you are? Is it necessary for you to carry with you all the time judgments about yourself? Is it sometimes reasonable to have a judgment-free day? Maybe sometimes it's useful to have a judgment or have an identity. We want you to have some identity. Well, here we don't care about your gender identity because the bathrooms are, you know, have no gender differentiation. But if places where there's, you know, men and women bathrooms, it's kind of useful to know your identity, your gender identity, kind of. Because, you know, I once went into the women's bathroom by mistake at some place, and when I came out of the toilet, I was surprised. And so were they. So that was embarrassing. So So the issue of identity, you know, what about an identity-free hour? That's what meditation is. Isn't that great? It's supposed to be. Identity-free time. That will assign in front of the meditation hall. Identity-free zone. So ease. Ease and the loss of it. The gain of it, regaining of it, and the way to regain it. So this is the flip side of the Four Noble Truths. And for some of you might find this more meaningful to as a framework to explore your life and what's going on than to look at it from the traditional framework of suffering, the cause, the end of suffering, and the way to it. In both ways, in both paths, the fourth truth, the way to the end, I think is the same. It works as the same very nicely. That the Eightfold Path is a very wonderfully integrated approach to creating the conditions that allows us to either look deeply at suffering or it allows us to begin experiencing ease. The greater our ease, the more effective is our ability to penetrate suffering, to understand deeply what it is. The greater our ease, the more ease becomes a reference point that supports our life and guides our life, and so that we can find greater ease or integrate ease or have ease be part of our life more often. So I'll leave you with a question. Why sacrifice your ease? For what is it worth sacrificing your ease? So we have about 10 minutes. If any of you would like to ask any questions or offer a really good counter-argument for, you know, where you kind of argue why, you know, some of you can come up with a really good reason for why it's worth giving up your ease. I saw your hand first. We like to use the mic for a couple of reasons. Some people can't hear otherwise. They have hearing, you know, the hearing system devices, and also they get recorded then, and the people on the recording like to hear the questions. Scary.
Okay, so every time you go on a little vacation or trip, you're giving up a little of your ease because there's the scrambling, the buying the tickets, the planning.
Really?
Well,
that's inherent in it. I'm going away a little vacation next weekend, and I'm going to start packing for it tonight, this afternoon, very easefully and nicely. Because I know that if I wait until Friday to do that, I'm not going to have much ease.
You've ruined my argument.
You sound disappointed.
I was so attached.
Well, you know, if you enjoy suffering, it's okay.
Well, I mean, wouldn't you say that it's a continuum? That when you're most at ease, you know, I'm at Starbucks drinking my latte and it's a beautiful day. There's my most at ease, let's say. But when I'm planning something, when I'm striving for something, I'm sort of giving up a little of that ease.
It sounds like you are.
Okay. That was.
So I think it's valuable if you know some experience in your daily life, like going have coffee, is where you experience the most ease. Take that seriously, that ease. And as you leave your coffee shop, watch yourself carefully. And notice when you start losing that ease. And as soon as you start losing it, stop. Sit down. Sit on a bench someplace. And just give yourself time to take stock. Just notice what happened right then. And notice, was it really necessary to give up the ease? What did you do? What were you doing in your mind? You know, when you... So it could be as simple as you got in your car And as soon as you turn the ignition on, you are in a hurry. I've got to get someplace quickly, because driving means, you know, you have to get someplace quickly. And so you feel, if you pay attention, you feel how there's an increased stress and tightness in the body with that. And then since you have this instruction, you would stop, you turn off the ignition. What just happened? And you question, is it really necessary to get tense because I'm driving? And you might say, no. Actually, I might be make a better driver if I'm not so tense. Let me see if I can get where I'm going without so much tension, without the pressure of driving, you know, being impatient. And you might try that. You try that, and you might learn, this is really nice. So nice, the next time you're at the coffee shop, you say, you know, this is nice being here, but what I like is the peace that I have when I'm here, the ease I'm having here. If I leave 3 minutes earlier than I was planning it, I can actually drive where I'm going and maintain that ease for longer. And so you're willing to give up the coffee shop for 3 minutes in order to have it continue rather than, you know, to hold on to that ease in the coffee shop as long as you possibly can, and then jump in your car and race and get a ticket. And make sense?
Yeah.
This is how I'm trying to give an example of how you would practice with this ease.
Thanks, Gil.
So, yes, please, Carla.
I've been deepening my practice and finding more ease, which is allowing me to do a great deal more productively. But the thing that throws me off is fear. And I seem to have developed little facility to... Well, I can bring myself back eventually, but how do you work with fear? It just throws me.
It's a good question. I think it's one of the great challenges of many people is to work with fear, anxiety, worry. Someone told me once that there's more anxiety in America than there is depression. And I don't know the statistics, but you know, depression gets a lot of press. But anxiety, a lot of anxiety. And so it's certainly something that's well worth our attention to pay attention to and stop for. It's good to recognize, what you recognize in yourself is very important. It's a stepping stone to this. And part of the approach in our tradition here would be to have a lot of compassion for that fear, but then to turn with that kindness and compassion towards it, try to understand it better, or turn towards it with mindfulness. The idea of mindfulness bringing mindfulness has a few different things involved. One is to learn how to be present for fear with some ease, some comfort level, you know, not be reactive to it, not be afraid. There are people who are afraid of their fear. There are people who get angry because of their fear, or get, you know, pushed around too much by their fear. And so it's a big learning step to learn how to have the inner strength or capacity to hold the fear, to be present for it. Some people learn to do that with mindfulness by imagining that they're very far away from it first. They're not too close, like they're looking at it across the valley. And you kind of don't get too close to it. Some people find that it's useful not to look directly at their fear, but rather to look at their reaction in relationship to the fear. The fear that they might have, the resistance to the fear they might have. And look at the secondary reaction for a while, because that's safer to do that than because the fear is too much. And then, you know, once that secondary reaction has fallen away, then maybe decide what's useful to do next. That's one of the functions of mindfulness, is to learn how to be present for fear without being excessive reactive to it, just to hold it there. Once we can have that kind of non-reactive awareness of fear, then it's possible to look at it more deeply and see what's going on, to begin questioning it, to understand the sources of it, and to bring a kind of healing awareness attention to the depths of that's a source of the fear. You know, an example that I think is relevant for adults even is the example of, you know, if you're working with a young child, maybe a 3 or 4 year old child who's afraid, you don't psychoanalyze them. You don't try to explain a lot to them about, what you try to do is you just offer your sense of safety by your presence and caring presence. And maybe the most complicated thing you might say is, it's okay, I'm here with you. And then something in the child can begin to relax. So the same thing with an adult. There's a kind of healing attention that can come when we bring ourselves to the source or the root of the fear. That is a different process than the process of cognitive understanding of what's going on. But mindfulness can do both. Mindfulness both helps us understand what's going on and also helps bring this kind of healing, kind of deeper, kind of caring attention. There's something about mindfulness that's closely akin to love. And so to bring this kind of mindful attention is kind of like bringing love to the fear and hold it. And this is a slow process, and it takes time and to learn to do it. It's really worthwhile doing. So that's what I'd say in short. I mean, I could give a whole talk about fear. I've spent a whole year talking about fear. It's a thing. Some people have a lot of it. And some people, it's counterindicated to approach the fear because it's just they panic with it. Sometimes it's really helpful to go into the fear or address it accompanied by someone else, so you're not doing it alone. In our culture, one of the most common ways to do it is to have a therapist. But there are other ways of getting someone to accompany you, so it's sometimes easier to go into it with the assistance of someone else. But one of the, in terms of the talk for today, what you want to be very careful with is the authority that you grant your fear, the authority that you grant worry, the authority that you grant anxiety. It's easy to be anxious, it's easy to be afraid, but there's a difference between being afraid and granting it a lot of authority. And if you begin questioning the authority, why am I granting this so much authority? Why do I believe it so much? Is a very interesting question. And it's possible to be afraid and not to believe it. And that's, you know, can seem like a foreign idea at first, but it makes it a lot easier to be afraid if you don't believe it. What?
Thank you.
It's a lot easier to be present for fear if you're not believing it. Okay, so may ease be your teacher. Thank you.